KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
This is one more example of the kind of sloppy, careless, incompetent behavior, particularly towards classified information.
On Capitol Hill, top U.S. intelligence officials faced intense questions from senators about information shared on Signal.
For Tuesday, March 25th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. As the Trump administration pursues deportation of several foreign-born scholars, we look back at the LA 8.
They were arrested decades ago on charges related to pro-Palestinian activism.
What we established in the LA 8 case was that the First Amendment protects all of us in the United States. It doesn't limit its protections to citizens.
And 23andMe just filed for bankruptcy. What happens to our data?
23andMe does provide the ability for folks to go ahead and delete their genetic profile.
Also, a look at the future of federal aid for small towns and farms.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. U.S. negotiators say Ukraine and Russia have come to terms on a ceasefire in the Black Sea. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports Kyiv and Moscow agree to ensure safe navigation, eliminate the use of force, and prevent the use of commercial vessels in the Black Sea for military purposes.
The development comes after days of talks in Saudi Arabia between the U.S. and the two adversaries. Ukraine successfully used air and sea drones early on in the war to drive Russia from the Black Sea and block Moscow's access to world markets for agricultural and fertilizer exports. Speaking after the agreement, President Volodymyr Zelensky said Ukraine is doing everything to end the war. We now need results from Russia, he said. The agreement did not involve any direct talks between Ukrainian and Russian officials. Ukraine had previously agreed to a full ceasefire, but so far Russia has rejected it. Moscow has continued to attack Ukrainian cities with missiles and drones. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Kyiv.
Trump administration officials continue to seek to downplay an incident where a journalist was apparently inadvertently added to a discussion of a U.S. military operation against Houthi rebels in Yemen. Top national security officials, including Trump's defense secretary, texted plans of the strike to the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic via an encrypted app. During a scheduled hearing today, top intelligence officials denied any classified material was shared. California fire officials have released new maps that show millions of acres at risk. It comes after the Los Angeles wildfires in January. More from NPR's Lauren Sommer.
California is one of the few states that maps where homes are at risk of wildfires. In some of those areas, that means new houses must be built with wildfire-resistant materials. Those building codes have been shown to increase the chances that a house will survive. The new maps mean that in Altadena, where the Eaton fire burned, some additional 500 buildings will have to rebuild with fire-resistant materials. But the majority of buildings, almost 8,000, will not. Some of the requirements could add to the cost of construction, but experts say building houses to resist wildfires helps make entire neighborhoods safer, especially as wildfires get more extreme. Lauren Sommer, NPR News.
Consumer confidence fell in March, NPR Scott Horsley reports.
Consumer confidence has been hovering in a fairly narrow range for more than 2 years, but it dipped below that level this month. While survey respondents still feel good about the current job market, their assessment of current business conditions and their outlook for the future worsened. The confidence index is compiled by the Conference Board, a nonprofit think tank. People who answered the survey say inflation is still a big concern, and many expect prices to climb even faster as a result of tariffs imposed by the Trump administration. More people say they're planning to buy big-ticket items, such as appliances and electronics, but rather than a vote of confidence in the economic outlook, that's seen as a largely defensive move to try to beat the looming import taxes. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. Supreme Court proceedings in Brazil will continue tomorrow as justices decide whether former President Jair Bolsonaro will stand trial for attempted coup. The far-right leader was charged with 5 counts of conspiring to overturn his 2022 election re-election loss, but it's up to the high court to see if a trial should move ahead. NPR's Carrie Kahn has more.
5 justices are overseeing the proceedings and spent the first day outlining the charges in the case against Bolsonaro. Prosecutors say Bolsonaro and 7 others formed a criminal conspiracy to upend democracy. The indictment also alleges that Bolsonaro plotted to poison the current president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, and kill the Supreme Court justice, who's now overseeing the proceedings. Bolsonaro attended the first day and denies any wrongdoing. His lawyer told the justice offices that Bolsonaro is the most investigated president in Brazilian history and pointed out the former president wasn't even in the country when his supporters ransacked government buildings on January 8, 2023. Kerry Khan, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
There have been a plethora of injuries involving baseball pitchers lately. The cause is not tough to figure out. They're hurling the ball at ever-increasing velocities and with maximum effort every pitch. What will be far more difficult for the sport is coming up with a solution. Some of the findings were detailed in a 62-page report issued by Major League Baseball in December. Now a study is backing that up with hard numbers. Crude oil futures prices fell today after an agreement in principle between Russia and Ukraine in the Black Sea. Oil down 23 cents a barrel to $68.88 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Baltimore.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Today, senators grilled top U.S. intelligence officials on Capitol Hill. This after The Atlantic reported that the magazine's top editor was added to a group chat on the widely available messaging app Signal, where top national security officials for the Trump administration were sharing details about military plans to bomb Yemen. We should note that NPR CEO Catherine Marr is chair of the board of Signal Foundation, which runs the Signal messaging app. At the Senate hearing today, here is what Georgia Democrat John Ossoff said.
This is utterly unprofessional. There's been no apology. There has been no recognition of the gravity of this error.
The top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, Mark Warner of Virginia, slammed the incident as mind-boggling. Senator Warner joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so you and your fellow Democrats, as expected, had pretty sharp words today for the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, and John Ratcliffe, head of the CIA, notably. None of your Republican colleagues seemed intent on focusing at all on this whole Signal episode. Do you have a sense of whether any of those Republicans share your concerns?
I think they do, and I think it was extraordinarily telling that none of my Republican colleagues came to these folks' defense. If anybody hasn't heard, let's just review very quickly. Signal is a good encrypted application, but it is not a classified means of transmitting information. Matter of fact, we have evidence that Russia and China have tried to break into Signal-based systems. Two, you've got this senior level of individuals communicating on this non-classified channel, and plain sloppiness put a journalist on, and nobody bothered to check who's this other person on the line.
But I ask you, if now, none of your Republican colleagues are willing to speak out against what happened, without their support in seeking accountability, are we going to see any accountability?
Well, I think we will. Listen, I think we're going to see this, the full text. I think the journalist is thinking about releasing it. And if they said, Gabbard said today, there's nothing classified, well, there's nothing classified, there's no reason why it shouldn't be released.
Right, fact, you though, said, okay, she share refused, it with the committee.
She refused to acknowledge whether at she first. Was using her phone, a government phone. But just, Elsa, step back for a moment. Even with what we know right now, we have the Vice President of the United States disagreeing with others about an imminent bombing. Having that information, if it had gone out ahead of time, I can tell you the Russia and China, Iran, that's what their spies would love to have. That very information alone in any traditional way would be viewed as classified and not supposed to be disclosed.
Let's talk about the classified nature or non-classified nature of the information, because you're right. Gabbard said that there was no classified material shared on that chat. But if Jeffrey Goldberg's reporting is correct, that text thread included the name of a CIA officer and information about targets, weapons the U.S. would be deploying, attack sequencing. Are there any conceivable circumstances where none of that information would be classified? You tell me.
There was no conceivable circumstance. And let me acknowledge, we overclassify in this country, but they shouldn't be changing the rules. And the hypocrisy here of the Director of National Intelligence, who literally 11 days ago tweeted out, like, we're going to go after every leaker and anybody that leaks, we're going to pursue to the full extent of the law. And then to be so cavalier and treat this information, because if it had gotten out, Americans could have died in terms of the Houthis being able to reconfigure or redirect their defensive capabilities. This is kind of security 101. If this had been a military officer or a CIA case officer, they would be fired with this kind of behavior, without question.
If it turns out that Jeffrey Goldberg and The Atlantic decide not to release further content of what Goldberg saw on that group chat, you did ask Gabbard today. You said, well, if nothing's classified, then share the contents with the committee. How do you proceed at that point if you want to see those contents that are apparently non-classified, according to her?
One of the things I have loved about the Intelligence Committee, I was chair under the last administration, I'm vice chair now, is that we have a tendency of almost always being bipartisan. I absolutely believe if the administration tries to stonewall this, we will have bipartisan support. For us as the Intelligence Committee, the oversight committee that's supposed to be making sure things are appropriate, we'll get a look at this transcript.
Let me ask you this.
Quick thing here on this. If this was the first time, it would still be awful, but it wouldn't be as awful as it is right now. This is the same administration that a couple weeks in inadvertently released the names of 200 CIA new agents, many of those who now can't be deployed. And this is the administration that Elon Musk and his so-called Doge boys release classified information almost on a daily basis.
All right. Well, we are now out of time. Thank you so much. That is Senator Mark Warner of Virginia, the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee. It was good to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
Just a few weeks ago, Hamdan Bahlul was standing on stage at the Academy Awards. He was collecting an Oscar after the film he co-directed called No Other Land won Best Documentary. The film depicts the violence and harassment Palestinians face in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. And last night, Bahlul lived that violence when his village in the West Bank was attacked by extremist Israeli settlers, and he was detained by the Israeli military. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf spoke to several eyewitnesses and brings this report.
Nasser Nawaje lives in the Palestinian village of Susia, the same village as Hamdan Bahlul. He says yesterday evening, right as everyone was getting ready to break the fast for the holy month of Ramadan, a group of settlers stormed part of the village. They attacked houses and smashed cars, he says, and started attacking people.
As soon as we sat down to eat, we received word that there was an attack near the school in Susia.
28-year-old Josh Kimmelman was in a nearby village when he got a message about the settlers in Susia. Kimmelman is an American, but staying in that part of the West Bank for several months as part of the Center for Jewish Nonviolence, a group that integrates with Palestinian villages at risk of Israeli attacks.
We call it protective presence.
Yesterday evening, he and several other activists drove the short distance to Susia to see if they could de-escalate the situation, but also to document it.
We pulled up, we could see the silhouettes of settlers and soldiers.
A few of them got out of the car and started filming, right as the settlers turned to attack them.
Hey, no, no!
A settler came towards us and started screaming at us. All their faces were covered. This one guy shoved me.
Jenna, also an American, is an activist with the same organization.
Back to the car!
So we tried to run back to our car, and settlers hit us with sticks.
NPR agreed not to use Jenna's last name because she doesn't want her employer to retaliate against her for her activism. In the video they filmed, you can see masked young men hurling rocks at the car, smashing the windshield and breaking the car windows while the activists are inside.
Guys, are you okay?
We're okay. The car is broken.
It was around this same time, the activists say, that Hamdan Bahlul was also beaten and then taken away by Israeli soldiers, along with two other Palestinians. The Israeli military said all three were throwing stones at security forces. The military says an Israeli was also taken into custody. All the eyewitnesses NPR talked to, who all know Belal, don't believe the charges against him. Here's Kimmelman.
He is committed as well, like us, to principles of nonviolence.
The film No Other Land documents events like those that took place last night, as violent settlers try to intimidate Palestinians into leaving their homes. Attacks have been on the rise since the 2023 war began in Gaza, and Israeli security forces often turn a blind eye. Belal was detained overnight at an Israeli military base, where he was interrogated by security forces, his lawyer told NPR. He was released later today. His lawyer says he immediately requested to be taken to the hospital for medical attention. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The first Black Republican Congresswoman has died. Mia Love represented Central Utah from 2015 to 2019. KUER's Sean Higgins reports on her life and career.
The daughter of Haitian immigrants, Love was born in New York and raised in Connecticut. It was there, while in college, she met her husband, who was on a Latter-day Saint mission. They moved to Utah in the late 90s. Love's political career began in the small city of Saratoga Springs, Utah, where she became the first Black woman mayor in the state. During her first run for Congress in 2012, she described her politics this way.
A lot of people have tried to put me in a box somewhere, and as everybody knows, I'm not easily put in a box. I hope that that message that I have of fiscal discipline, limited government, personal responsibility resonates from Tea Party all the way over to moderate.
Utah Lieutenant Governor Deidre Henderson, a close friend, said while Love may have achieved many firsts, she never let them define her.
She understood that she was breaking barriers and that she was first in a lot of those things, but she herself never leaned on that. So when people called her a rising star, it wasn't because she was a Black female Republican. It was because she was really talented.
In Congress, Love was a reliable conservative vote and served on a House panel that investigated Planned Parenthood. In Congress during President Trump's first term, Love did not shy away from criticizing him after he used an expletive to describe Haiti and developing countries in Africa. Love said the comments were racist and called on Trump to apologize. Here she is in the audiobook of her 2023 memoir.
To have a president of the United States of America who seemed incapable of having relationships, only convenient transactions, mock you after a tough election loss, or call your ancestral home a can be devastating, disconcerting, and disappointing.
After leaving office in 2019, she worked as a political commentator at CNN. Love was first diagnosed with brain cancer in 2022 and publicly shared it a year later. Mia Love was 49 years old. For NPR News, I'm Sean Higgins in Salt Lake City.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. One morning in January of 1987, Michel Shahada, a Palestinian man who'd lawfully emigrated to the United States as a teenager, was taking care of his toddler son at home when federal agents arrived at his door and arrested him at gunpoint. Shahada soon learned he was one of eight immigrants, mostly students and known as the LA 8, arrested on charges relating to their pro-Palestinian activism. Fast forward to this month, when federal agents arrested Mahmoud Khalil, a recent Columbia University graduate student, and Georgetown professor Badar Khansouri. Like the LA 8, both are in the U.S. legally, being threatened with deportation, and both are targets of the Trump administration's crackdown on what they describe as anti-Semitic pro-Hamas speech on college campuses across the country. For insight into this moment and what we can learn from the plight of the LA 8, we turn now to David Cole. He represented the LA 8 over their 20-year fight to remain in the United States. David Cole, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I just want to start by asking you, as briefly as you can, could you just walk us through what happened to the LA 8?
Well, as you indicated in your opening, they were arrested at gunpoint. They were all detained initially as national security threats. When we challenged that assertion, the government said it wanted to rely on secret evidence that we couldn't see to show that they were security threats. The judge said, no, I'm not going to look at secret evidence unless you can show it to the defendants, essentially. And the government said, okay, well, then we're not going to show it to the judge either, and they were allowed out. After about the first month, they were free for the entire 20-year saga of their case, but it took 20 years to prevail in a case in which the government targeted our clients for essentially advocating for Palestinian self-determination.
As you mentioned, these cases went on for more than two decades. How did that affect the lives of the LA 8, their families?
Well, the principal restriction on them was that they weren't able to leave the country. And so a number of them lost parents who were living back in Palestine and were unable to go see their parents in the last years, months, days of their lives without giving up their right to stay in this country. And they just had for two decades hanging over their heads the fact that they may lose the right to be in this country despite the fact that they engaged in no unlawful activity because of what they said and what they believed in.
What are the similarities that you see between their case and those that are being brought today against Mahmoud Khalil and the others?
Well, it's really deja vu all over again. The government is targeting Palestinians engaged in nothing more than protest activities on campuses. Why? Because the government disagrees with the viewpoints expressed. And so they are seeking to deport people for their speech. And what we established in the LA 8 case was that the First Amendment protects all of us in the United States.
In order to pursue these deportations, the government is using a rarely invoked part of the Immigration and Nationality Act that allows the U.S. Secretary of State to deport any non-citizen whose presence in the U.S. could be deemed to have, and I'm quoting here, adverse foreign policy consequences for the United States. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has made the claim that Khalil's case, at least, it's not about free speech, but it's about who is and who is not allowed to be in the country to begin with. What do you make of that argument?
First of all, the notion that a college student's speech on a single campus in the United States somehow poses serious adverse foreign policy consequences is laughable. But in addition, it's a violation of the First Amendment, because what is the basis upon which he says Mr. Khalil's activities undermine our foreign policy? Nothing more than his pure speech. And speech is protected for all of us.
If the government is successful in deporting someone like Khalil or Badar Khansouri,
What kind of ripple effects might that have for free speech in the United States?
Well, it will send a tremendous chill across this country, and that is its intention. President Trump on Truth Social essentially said, you know, this is the first step. We're going to go after anyone who engages in what he calls illegal protests, which he seems to define as protests he doesn't like. But the First Amendment is here to say that is not the government's prerogative. The government in the United States has to tolerate speech, even speech that it disapproves of, especially speech that it disapproves of.
David Cole is a former lawyer for the LA 8 and national legal director for the ACLU. He is now at Georgetown Law. David, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain Podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. And today's story comes from Eleanor Higginbotham. It was December 31st, 2022, and her first New Year's Eve alone. Higginbotham's husband of 62 years, Erland, had died in June. That afternoon, she went to the post office to drop off some holiday cards, and when she returned to her car, it wouldn't start. So she went back to the post office and asked the people inside if anyone could jump her car. Right away, a woman volunteered, joined by a friend.
And they were working and working and working and nothing. It was totally dead. And another couple of cars came in. Finally, we had four cars in the parking lot, all of them trying to help this old lady. Finally, somebody did start the car. It was about 40 minutes, I think, that people were working on it. Everybody was very worried about this old lady getting home because now it was dark. And I said, everybody should come home with me and have a tea party. You can follow me. The first woman, Sumaya, was the one who stayed for the whole thing. Sumaya followed me home. And not only did she come home with me, but she came upstairs with me. And we did, in fact, have a tea party. We had cookies and tea, and we started talking. And we found that we had a lot in common. You know, I had concerns with aging and losing a husband and what I was going to do next. She had her own concerns. And we were really quite frank with each other, two strangers who really had known nothing about each other, became pretty close in a period when the world seems pretty intent on meanness, stinginess, greediness, and all of that. This was great generosity of time and skill and attention. I'm an Emily Dickinson scholar. I love her work. And when this event happened to me, I thought of this poem of hers. A deed knocks first at thought, and then it knocks at will, and then goes out an act. That's what goodness is about, really, is action. But first of all, of course, it has to come from the mind and the heart, and these people who are kind did that.
Eleanor Higginbotham lives in Bethesda, Maryland. She and Sumaya Zane are still friends. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at myunsunghero.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Mathnasium, committed to making math fun and building confidence so students can achieve their potential this school year, offering customized math instruction and individual attention to students in grades K through 12. Mathnasium.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Lollapalooza defined what rock would become in the early 90s, with bands such as Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, and Green Day performing on their main stage. Today, well, it's just not something that could be put together quite easily.
A festival like this that would tour around the country with this many artists of that stature is actually impossible to do.
The history of Lollapalooza, tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Congressional Republicans strategize on how to push back on federal judges ruling against the Trump administration.
Just getting an impeachment bill through the House would send a pretty clear message to rogue activist judges.
That story after this summary of the day's news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. President Trump is defending his national security advisor and downplaying an incident in which the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic got highly sensitive military plans to strike Iran-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen before it happened. Trump says there was no classified information in that group chat, but the president says it could happen.
It seems to be the number one used device or app, whatever you want to call it, and we will certainly look. If it was up to me, everybody would be sitting in a room together. The room would have solid lead walls and a lead ceiling and a lead floor. But, you know, life doesn't always let you do that. In the meantime, the attack itself that we were talking about and discussing has been an unbelievable success.
The journalist says it appears he was added to the chat group by National Security Advisor Mike Walls, the same man Trump says will lead the probe into what happened. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is heading to a regional gathering in Jamaica. That's where migration and drug trafficking will be high on the agenda tomorrow, as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Secretary Rubio is a former Florida senator, a Cuban-American, and his aides point out that he has deep ties to the Caribbean and Latin America. Special Envoy for Latin America, Mauricio Claver Caron, says the Secretary of State wants to focus on energy security in a region that was once, in his words, extorted by Venezuela. Rubio will also be talking about how the U.S. can help develop energy industries in Suriname and Guyana during stops there. As for Haiti, Rubio's aides say he will be hearing from Haitian officials and regional partners in Jamaica on how they can help Haitian police prevent gangs from retaking the capital of Port-au-Prince. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
This is NPR. Atlanta rapper Playboi Carti has the number one album in the country. NPR's Hazel Seal says his third album comes after years of delays.
Playboi Carti has been teasing his third album, titled Music, for years now. This week, the album debuts at number one on the Billboard Albums chart, the rapper's second album to do so. The album has had the biggest week for a rap album in 2025, and it marks the biggest streaming week for an album since Taylor Swift released The Tortured Poets Department last year. Playboi Carti also has two songs in the top 20, Evil Jordan and Rather Lie, featuring The Weeknd. Hazel Sills, NPR News.
Well, the latest survey of consumer confidence fell for the fourth month in a row as Americans' view of their financial futures dropped to the lowest level in 12 years. The Conference Board report out today shows inflation is still a big concern, and many people surveyed expect prices to rise even faster, driven by tariffs imposed by the Trump administration. Some consumers even looking to buy appliances and other big ticket items before the additional tariffs go into effect next month. On Wall Street, stocks finished slightly higher today on Wall Street. The Dow gained about 4 points. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments, As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their client's best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at metamucil.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Baltimore.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Republicans on Capitol Hill say that federal judges ruling against the Trump administration are abusing their power.
It's like we have hundreds of mini Supreme Courts.
Missouri Senator Josh Hawley wants to prevent federal district judges from issuing rulings that have far-reaching national implications. Other Republicans have another idea, impeachment. NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh joins us now from the Capitol. Hi, Deirdre.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so checks and balances in the Constitution. Yes, Congress has oversight authority over the federal judiciary. Do Republican lawmakers have a clear plan on how they want to do that?
Well, they have a range of ideas, but they're not really united on what they want to do. It is worth noting that there are a series of decisions ruling against Trump, executive orders and other actions by the administration. And these have come from judges that were appointed by both Democratic and Republican presidents. The biggest one causing the most blowback from Republicans in Congress comes from U.S. District Court Judge James Boasberg.
Right.
He questioned President Trump's use of the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 to deport some Venezuelans to El Salvador. The administration says those individuals were part of a gang that's labeled a terrorist organization. President Trump has already called for this judge's impeachment, and Texas Republican Brandon Gill filed a resolution to do that. It's worth noting Elon Musk has also called for impeachment. Teaching judges that have ruled against some of his actions to reshape the federal government. Gill told me he thinks in Boasberg's case, the judge is stepping on the commander-in-chief's authority to remove people he thinks are a threat.
But have House Republicans lined up the votes to impeach this judge or any other judges whom they have disagreed with?
No, and even some House Republicans admit they don't have the votes to do that. You know, I asked Senate Majority Leader John Thune about this push by House Republicans to impeach judges, and he told me he thinks the appeals process is how disagreements over judges' decisions will ultimately be how this all gets handled. Democrats, for their part, are causing the push to impeach or any other moves against judges as political retribution.
Well, just remind us, Deirdre, what would it actually take to impeach a federal judge?
First, a House would have to pass an impeachment resolution. Even if the House had the votes to do that, Republican Tom Tillis, who's on the Senate Judiciary Committee, told me that impeachment would be, in his words, an unmitigated waste of time. That's because it takes a supermajority, 67 votes, to convict and remove a judge. It's unlikely that any Democrats would vote with Republicans. Mm-hmm. I actually pressed Gill about this sort of political reality, and he said he still thinks the House should act.
What we can do in the House is separate from that, and I think just getting an impeachment bill through the House would send a pretty clear message to rogue activist judges.
Okay, well, if impeachment does not work, what are the other Republican proposals to restrict the federal courts?
One proposal Republicans on both sides of the Capitol are talking about is limiting the power of district judges to issue injunctions. That's actually expected to get a House vote next week. California Republican Darrell Issa sponsored the bill, and he talks about it as a way to combat what he says is a trend of district judges applying their rulings about the cases before them more broadly.
And it goes back to the very creation of district courts. We don't need a Supreme Court if 700 judges can each do what the Supreme Court does.
We heard Missouri Republican Josh Hawley talking about that issue. He has a similar bill. He says that leaving decisions with national implications to the Supreme Court is really the way he argues the system is supposed to work. Of course, President Trump appointed three of the justices on the Supreme Court, and there's a conservative majority on the high court right now.
That is NPR's Deirdre Walsh. Thank you so much, Deirdre.
Thanks, Elsa.
It's been a turbulent couple of months at the government agency committed to helping rural economies. It's called USDA Rural Development, and the turmoil it faces may erode a major source of federal aid for small towns and farms. Frank Morris of member station KCUR reports.
Raising big animals for meat is tough, and on small farms, the owners do all the work.
It's
not a job that you can just shut on and off. It's a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week job, and sometimes you question your life choices when it's negative 25 wind chill. Yeah, checking calves, cutting ice, making sure that everyone's warm, you know.
Jenna Batchelder and her husband Brad and their four kids raise cattle, bison, pigs, and poultry near Belton, Missouri, south of Kansas City. They've had this farm for a decade and spent most of that time living in a walled-off and furnished section of the barn. When the pandemic hit and shut down big meatpacking plants, they saw an opportunity to sell individual cuts of meat. Brad Batchelder says a grant from USDA Rural Development made it possible.
Yeah, I mean, it was really almost life-changing for us. This grant has definitely, like, we see a path and a vision now, and that has been even more motivating to us, I think.
You see some of our steaks that we sell.
Now they're running a thriving meat shop out of the corner of the barn where they used to live.
Pork is in here. We have our beef products in this freezer here.
USDA Rural Development covers up to half their processing costs. That investment flows through the rural economy to local butchers and other suppliers and makes the food supply chain just a little stronger. USDA Rural Development is Washington's chief tool to promote economic growth in rural counties, where President Trump won, on average, almost two-thirds of the vote last year, according to AP Votecast. But Kyle Wilkins, who ran USDA Rural Development in Missouri under President Biden, says the agency is in turmoil.
Because they don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
The Trump administration first pressed USDA Rural Development employees to retire, then terminated hundreds. Now the courts are forcing the agency to rehire workers with back pay, at least temporarily.
Think of the time that you're taken away from these folks doing their actual job, and that is money. It's all it is. It's money.
And money is getting tight. Congress cut USDA Rural Development by hundreds of millions of dollars last year. Owen Hart with the National Association of Counties says the agency does things that local governments can't afford, building water supply systems for small shrinking towns, for instance, shoring up hospitals, buying police cars. It's an economic lifeline to places without a lot of options.
In a lot of these communities, USDA Rural Development is the most important partner. You can't rely on private investment coming in. The market's just often not there for it. You can't rely on philanthropy like you can in a lot of urban areas to meet some of these needs. And so rural development is a really, really crucial partner.
That includes manufacturers that President Trump is counting on to boost U.S. industrial production. Here's Kyle Wilkins again, standing outside the Miller's Custom Cabinet Factory in Excelsior Springs, Missouri, half an hour northeast of Kansas City.
That is a huge industrial building that they're making cabinets in. And half of it, which I'd say at least half a football field, is covered in solar panels. They are saving a lot of money right now in electric cost.
USDA Rural Development covered half the price of the solar array, $250,000. Wilkins says the savings will help management thrive and maybe hire more people, strengthening the economy here. Farm state politicians will work to shore up the agency that's done so much for their constituents over the decades. But Wilkins says it'll take time to heal the damage recently inflicted on USDA Rural Development. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris in Kansas City.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. In March, the World Health Organization said that more than 200 healthcare facilities had shut down or suspended operations in Afghanistan, all as a result of the Trump administration's freeze on aid funding. It said without urgent intervention, about 200 more facilities would shut down by June. On the ground, Afghan midwives tell NPR that they are already seeing the impact. NPR's Dia Hadid reports, and please note that her story includes details about the deaths of women and babies.
The midwives spoke to NPR on condition of anonymity. They were critical of the Taliban and worry for their personal safety. They were also critical of the Trump administration and worry they'll lose their jobs, which are funded by foreign aid groups, if they're identified. That's why we've only used their first names. Laikva is a midwife who used to work in a health clinic in an isolated mountainous district. It was shut down, even as locals begged staff not to go. This week, Faiza says, she got word that a woman and her baby died in childbirth in that district. Her area was snowed in. She couldn't get to a regional hospital. Other women reach hospitals when it's too late. Midwife Karima tells NPR that one woman lost so much blood that she died on the way to the hospital where she works. Another woman, Fatima, tells NPR she encountered a woman who arrived with a baby stuck in her birth canal at the hospital where she works. She encountered another woman whose baby's legs had emerged, but the head was stuck inside. She says both those babies died. Fatima says she's from a deeply poor district. Most women, she says, give birth at home and die at home, unrecorded, because families can't afford a taxi to get a woman to hospital. Other families in her conservative area refuse to let women leave their homes, even to have a baby. She says healthcare in Afghanistan has always been tenuous, especially for women. She says it became worse after the Taliban seized power over 3 years ago. The group has banned women and girls from studying after the sixth grade. There's no new nurses, midwives, or healthcare workers. So losing US aid was a cruel blow. She says no one prioritizes women's lives. And the Trump administration's cuts to USAID triggered a domino effect of sorts. Soon after, the British Prime Minister announced his country would nearly halve its budget for foreign aid, the lowest level in nearly 30 years. He said that was to divert resources to defense spending as Washington shrinks back from its traditional NATO allies. Then a series of European countries announced cuts to their foreign aid, citing budgetary constraints, a desire to pivot to their national self-interest, and a need to spend more on defence. Heather Barr is from Human Rights Watch. She's followed Afghanistan closely for decades.
It seems to be that other donors are following the US down, and that what Trump has done really is give everyone a license to give up on funding aid.
She says it's like the Trump administration has given the wealthy West permission to not care about Afghan women. Dear Hadid, NPR News, Mumbai.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ilse Chang. Some say a Wisconsin state election next Tuesday is a test for President Trump. Elon Musk has poured more than $18 million into the contest so far. On the other side, mega wealthy donors George Soros and Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker each have given more than $1 million. Chuck Kornbach of member station WUWM brings us more.
It's a race for a single seat on the Wisconsin Supreme Court that has raised as much as $100 million. It's likely the most expensive state Supreme Court election in the country's history. The last time a record was set for a state Supreme Court race was 2 years ago in Wisconsin.
Well, Wisconsin, guess what? We did it! We did it!
Winning candidate Janet Protasiewicz celebrated on election night in 2023 after giving liberals a court majority for the first time since 2008. Now that another liberal justice on the nonpartisan court is retiring, Republicans are again making a play for control. Elon Musk-funded ads take aim at the Democrats' favorite Supreme Court candidate, Dane County Circuit Judge Susan Crawford.
That was Crawford's choice.
One commercial argues Crawford gave a light sentence to a man who sexually assaulted a child.
Another dangerous decision from Susan Crawford, putting all our kids at risk. She's just wrong for Wisconsin.
Crawford defends her decisions for those found guilty and says what's out of place in Wisconsin are Musk's Political Action Committee's efforts to turn out voters for her opponent, Waukesha County Circuit Judge Brad Schimmel.
The Musk PACs are distributing flyers that say protect the Trump agenda with Brad Schimmel. That's obviously a very partisan message, and it's not what the Wisconsin Supreme Court is for.
Musk has claimed his top concern is that if Crawford is elected, the liberal state court would redistrict two Wisconsin House seats to give Democrats a chance to win the chamber in 2026. Musk said that this past weekend when he welcomed Schimmel on his social media platform, X.
And then we won't be able to get through the changes that the American people want.
Democratic House Leader Hakeem Jeffries also said this week that the Wisconsin contest is important for House redistricting. But Crawford says she hasn't made any promises on redrawing congressional lines. Also over the weekend, President Trump endorsed Schimmel. The conservative judge told reporters he made no promises in return.
Absolutely nothing. He called me and he knows about the race and he knows that it's important that we have the rule of law in Wisconsin.
Crawford is also getting help from well-known billionaires, including George Soros and Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker. Her campaign says she alone has raised more than $26 million since entering the race, an amount they say is more than any other judicial race in American history. And Wisconsin Democratic Party Chair Ben Wickler has been holding something he calls People versus Musk town halls.
The world's richest man, not content to be running the federal government, is also trying to buy our state Supreme Court.
After this town hall, Deb Kohler, who calls herself an independent voter from a mostly Republican family, criticized Musk's cuts to the federal government.
You need to go in and do analysis. In corporate America, you just don't fire a whole generation of people. Think of it.
There is some indication that all the out-of-state spending is wearing on Wisconsin voters. At one Republican rally, Mike Miller said as much.
Personally, I think it's gotten out of hand on both sides.
But Miller says he's still voting for Schimmel in the nonpartisan race for the Wisconsin Supreme Court. For NPR News, I'm Chuck Kornbach in Milwaukee.
By now, millions of Americans have spit into a tube and sent it to 23andMe for a detailed DNA analysis. But the California biotech company struggled for years to overcome the fact that many of them were one-and-done customers. Now, 23andMe is filing for bankruptcy with the goal of finding a buyer, and that has raised questions about what could happen to the sensitive information of its more than 15 million users. John Verde is Senior Vice President for Policy at the Future of Privacy Forum, and he joins me now to talk about all of it. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, John, if you could just start by laying out exactly what this bankruptcy filing means for users. What kinds of laws protect the types of data that we're talking about here?
Well, there are some state laws, there are some federal laws that protect the data, but what it really comes down to is that those laws typically focus on the uses and not parties. There's no obligation that 23andMe delete the data before, you know, selling the company. And that means that this information in past bankruptcies involving other sorts of data, personal information has been transferred to successor entities. And some folks are worried about that. Some folks are not worried about that. But that's the reality from where it is in the United States these days in terms of regulation.
The company is trying to find a buyer, and in a press release about the bankruptcy filing, the company says they're, quote, committed to continuing to safeguard customer data and being transparent about the management of user data going forward. I have to tell you, as someone, full disclosure, who has used 23andMe, I was a little concerned. So I'd love to know, in your view, how big of a risk is there of a user's genetic information ending up in someone else's hands?
Well, given the statements, I think it's pretty clear that that genetic information is going to end up in another entity's hands unless individuals delete their information. And that's something that they can do on the 23andMe website. 23andMe does provide the ability for folks to go ahead and delete their genetic profile, which is the data that was generated from the sample that you submitted. They also have the ability to go ahead and ensure that the company has destroyed the underlying biological sample. And that's typically more relevant for folks who have submitted the test more recently, but it's an important distinction between the data and the actual physical sample that the company did collect.
What types of protections exist in the event that a buyer does purchase 23andMe? Could a different company do whatever they want to with that data at that point?
A new company can definitely not do whatever they want to at that point. The successor entity would be bound by the original privacy promises and the terms and conditions that 23andMe made. And what that means is that if 23andMe could legally use the information for research, for example, today, then the successor entity could use that for research in the future. But if 23andMe promised not to, say, engage in targeted advertising with third parties using that genetic data, then the successor entity would likewise not be allowed to engage in that sort of activity.
Say someone listening to our conversation, they've sent in their genetic sample. They're now worried about where that data could end up, what it could be used for. What would you say to them?
I'd say if you're one of those one and done users who hasn't really engaged with 23andMe since they sent in their sample and got their test results and learned a little bit about their heritage or their health, folks might want to think seriously about either deleting the data or rethinking whether or not they are comfortable with an entity that is not 23andMe, which is somebody who they trusted, who they sent their information to, whether they're comfortable with another entity who's kind of unknown at this time, collecting, using that data in a way that is consistent with 23andMe's practices, but they're a different entity, right? They don't necessarily have that trust relationship today because that successor entity is by definition unknown.
That's John Verde. He's Senior Vice President for Policy at the Future of Privacy Forum. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And if you're looking to delete your data, NPR.org has a helpful step-by-step guide.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Sony Pictures Classics presenting The Penguin Lessons, a new comedy starring Steve Coogan as a teacher whose life is upended after he rescues a penguin from an oil-slicked beach. Starts Friday in theaters. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from the
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
And I walked in the water in my cargo car. My hands in the water in my cargo car. And if I get a little bit of whatever I got, Lordy Lord, Lordy Lord, hey, 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 Lord, I say, hey.